The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse, unscripted. Now, here's your host, John Horn.
Coming up on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we meet Ron Cephas Jones. He has a huge star turn in the NBC series This Is Us. He's a veteran actor who used his acting skills to crush it on TV. So stay with us, Ron Cephas Jones on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Alone is back for its fourth season, but this time around the rules have changed. 10 hardcore survivalists will still be dropped into the unforgiving wilderness, but that is where the similarities with previous seasons end. These 10 participants are composed of 5 competing teams, brothers, fathers, and sons, and a married couple who all have unbreakable bonds. The competitors will be split apart and dropped off as individuals, equipped with their 10 items, 5 each. In order to win the game, they must mobilize, find each other, and survive on the island together longer than the other competing pairs. They will face extreme isolation and psychological distress, both individually and together, as they plunge into the unknown, self-documenting their experiences along the way. Can they work together, or will the strength of their bond crumble beneath the anvil of Mother Nature? At stake is $500,000 awarded to the team that can last the longest. The season also brings viewers back to North Vancouver Island, where the threat of predators is fiercer than last season, and the weather is the harshest they've seen yet. So be sure to tune in to Alone's The New Season when it premieres Thursday, June 15th at 10 o'clock, 9 central on History.
This is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
We are on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. We are welcoming Ron Cephas Jones, poet, actor, man about town. What else should we call you?
That sounds good to me, brother.
Ron, great to see you.
Good to be here. Great to be seen.
I want to ask you something that I noticed in looking over your body of work, and it's something whenever I go to Broadway and I look at the playbill, Law and Order. Law and Order has got to be the lifeblood for every actor who's trying to get by.
Well, it was like the
on
only
Broadway.
It was the only stream in town at the time. You know what I mean? To go and get a drink from in regards to like television and film, you know, over on Pier 62 over at the Hudson, you know. So, you know, used to see a lot of actors walking back and forth from that long walk from the train station over to the river going and coming, you know. So for a long time, that was it. And, you know, shows like New York Undercover and NYPD Blue, you know, they were the only things that were in town, actually, you know, where you can get some film stuff. And everybody else was trying to get out to L.A., you know, so that was the only thing, you know. So I did a couple of those and all the New York shows that I could do while they were there.
I'm looking at it. New York Undercover, Law and Order. Yep. NYC 22.
That's it. Yeah, yeah.
Frank Doyle, Law and Order. Yeah. Roland Brooks, Law and Order. Reggie Banks, Law and Order, SVU. And I remember reading in some story that there was a limit to how many Law and Order actors could do because the audience would say, wait, wasn't he killed
that's
off
right,
like
that's
2 years
right.
ago and now he's a cop?
Right, right. Lead gets leads. You can only do so many, you know what I mean? Yeah.
But it's work, and it's
yeah,
work
right.
that is union work,
that's
and
right. That's right.
it probably pays better than doing a show.
Absolutely.
On
also,
the stage.
It's about exposure, you know, getting an opportunity as a New York actor to get exposed to some of the people here in Los Angeles, producers, agents, directors, things like that. And it's changed over the last several years, and they have maybe like 3 now sound stages, 3-4 sound stages in New York where they're doing all the Amazon stuff, Netflix. So that's also another opportunity. And that's where I came into picture. Later on, I started to catch the wave of shows that were booking from New York because they were filming in New York. So hence, you know, Banshee, AMC's Low Winter Sun that I had for one season that shot in Detroit but cast out of New York. The Luke Cage, the Get Down. Mr. Robot, which was filming at Silver Cup Studios. So it gave me an opportunity. Also, the writers, you know, a lot of the writers were playwrights. So you started to see playwrights writing in these shows. And so hence the playwrights would try to bring some of the actors they had worked with before. And so it kind of opened New York up to this other film world that we didn't have access to before.
Right, because there used to be a stratification that people who did theater did theater,
that's
people
right.
who did TV, and people who did film, and yeah. the hierarchy was film on top, TV in the middle, and theater
that's
for the
right.
guys. You hope you could get a guest
that's
spot.
Right, that's
and
right.
And now it's turned upside down.
That's right, that's right. And you're seeing a lot more of that. You see a lot more theater actors on these shows and directors who worked in the theater before, and especially the writers.
And the other thing I would say, and this must be great as an actor who has done theater where there is incredible writing, is that you're working in an age where the writing on television and streaming services now is as good as it's ever been, and it's as good as a lot of plays on Broadway. So as an actor, what is that like to see dialogue in sides that you'd say, this looks as good as anything I've done on Broadway?
Oh, John, you hit it right on the head, man. That's exactly what every actor looks for. It's like a dream come true, you know, to have the writing that's consistent with a playwright. Dan Fogelman writes like a playwright. You can tell in the monologues that he writes. So that was one of the beauties of getting this gig. And, like, again, you start to see that more where the level of competition has been raised, the bar has been raised coming from the writing. The better the writing, you need better actors to be in those roles. And also, you don't need an actor of prestige who has a long resume in television and film to book them in these particular roles. You know, you can use other actors that are just very good at what they do, but don't maybe have a name. You know, so you used to be able to produce and say, oh, he's great, but nobody knows him. Well, it's like, well, give him the job, and then we'll know him, you know, so that's starting to happen now.
I can't help but imagine among actors who are as well-trained with as many credits as you, when you're on a TV set or a film set, and there's an actor who's really good-looking, kind of movie star-ish, but really can't act a lick. Do you all get in the corner and just say, why him and not me?
Well, that's an unwritten thing to say.
You say it, but
you don't say it, okay. Right.
But you know it.
That's right. That's right. You know, and certainly, you know, like I said, the tide has changed, but certainly you can feel that. You know, everyone comes with whatever they have to come with and try to contribute to whatever it is. So This Is Us is just a very unique situation when you get that many good actors, you know, that have the ability to put across characters and layers in characters, you know. So, and I, you know, it's one of my things that I do, you know, from the theater, from the way I work, the technique and things like that. So it's a match made in heaven. You know?
Well, we're going to talk about technique in a little bit, but I want to talk about the casting director, Tiffany Little Canfield, who cast This Is Us.
Yeah.
She did an interview recently, and she was talking about working with Dan Fogelman. And Dan was describing the character on This Is Us that you ended up playing. And this is what Tiffany said. He was describing Ron Cephas Jones. He didn't know Ron, but he was describing him. So that was one of our first actors put on tape in New York. I think the reason Ron and so many brilliant New York actors are being discovered this late in their career is because the opportunity is there.
That's perfect. It's just perfect. Opportunity isn't always about getting an opportunity to just give me an opportunity to let me in the door. It's very difficult. It took me years to bust through that quote-unquote television film door, you know, and mainly because I never came out to L.A. I had, when I started, I had just 2 years after I got back into the business, I had, my daughter was born, and I didn't really want to leave New York. I wanted to be around, to be a full-time dad, to be there for bicycle riding and baby diaper changing and picking up from school and homework, and I wanted to be involved in all that. So I decided not to go to L.A., and I picked up a lot of theater jobs and just expanded that and used it, and quite frankly was very content with that. You know, it's the financial up and downs are the only thing that, and that was just more about fear. So once you battle with the fear, understand that it's really fear that you're fearing, and you have really everything that you need. Things just started to open up. I started to fall in love with the craft of it. And it took me around the world. I've done theater in London several times, you know. So instead of going west, my career started taking me east and doing theater.
Going away from Hollywood.
Yeah, and just expanding and broadening my work base and the places that I can go, from O'Neill to August Wilson to Shakespeare to, you know, all the great writers. So it gave me an opportunity in all those years to really learn and define myself as a good stage actor.
I want to ask about technique, because I think a lot of actors who haven't studied seriously don't understand what technique is, and there's varying schools
That's
of
right.
study.
That's right.
There's Stanislavski,
That's right.
there's Udo Hagen, there's Meisner.
That's
and
right.
I think Meisner is an important person to you.
Yes, he is, yeah.
Describe the technique and what you found in it and how it helps you as an actor.
Well, how I found it, I came through it by way of Philip Seymour Hoffman, to be honest. I got involved in a theater company called Labyrinth Theater Company. And I had been working similarly in the way of Meisner, but didn't know how to identify it. And it was Philip Seymour Hoffman who really brought it to my attention, gave me an understanding of what he called actioning. And Meisner's based on actions as opposed to feelings. You know, the feeling will come after the action, like life itself. Once something happens, then you feel from it, as opposed to trying to conjure the feeling before the action happens, which creates nerves, which creates why the actor is always nervous.
That's kind of the whole sense memory school.
That's right.
But this is the opposite.
This is the opposite.
Show me, don't tell me.
That's right. Show me, don't tell me, and then the feelings will come behind that. So he worked very much with that. And another director who he learned from, Mark Wing Davies, who's also the head of the NYU department at NYU Theater Drama Department, and also a great director from England called Max Stafford Clark, who does specific actioning, where he would action almost every sentence or every word in the entire script. So you would have to find an action word for it, an action phrase for it. And he would meticulously go through the script doing that. And his auditions was like that also, where you would come in and you wouldn't perform for him. He would sit you down and see how you understood the script. He wanted to know whether the actor could get underneath and find the actions that are in the script. What am I doing and why am I doing it? Those are the first two most important questions. So it all starts from the why and the action, more about what am I doing. And then as I'm doing it, I'll start to feel what I'm supposed to feel naturally from my sense memory and also from my history as a person. Whatever those feelings are, they'll start to flood back, because my subconscious is open now. So that's how you can use the work from your subconscious. Also, things are already there. Every word is already written. Every poem is already written. Every book is already written. It's just the words are just moved around in different configurations to make another book, to make another song. The notes are there. It's how you configure them. And so that's the basis of it. You know, Phil and Mark Wing Davies and Max Stafford Clark and people like that just took it to another level and start to personalize it and make it your own thing, how you would want to do it.
So what is it like if you are doing a play and it's an ensemble and there's maybe a dozen actors and each actor has his or her own unique way of getting ready to go on stage or through rehearsal? They're going to do different techniques, different warm-ups. If people stumbled upon that scene, would it look like, you know, zoo animals trying to get out of the cage? What would they see? Because everybody has a different path, and some of those paths are going to be really loud and very physical, and some of those paths are going to be, I need to be in a dark room, you know,
yeah,
murmuring to myself.
And that's a great question, John. That's where the director comes in. That's why you have to have a good director. So you have writer, director, actor, and those three have to work in conjunction. The writer has to deliver all the information through the director. So the writer and actor ne'er shall meet. Maybe in the first week, you get questions in with the writer, but the writer should direct all their interests and their concerns through the director to the actor. If the writer wants to say something to the actor, of course, the writer can pull the actor aside and say something. But if it's about the technique or it's about the work, it should go through the director. The director should be able to have the knowledge about how each of his actors work and then incorporate his directing based on leaning toward the strengths of all those actors. It's the director that has to pull that together. The actor just focuses on what he needs to do as far as the script is concerned and who he's looking at also. So there could be some problems there, but each actor has to go to the director to solve it. You shouldn't solve it between the actors. Then you can get into a lot of trouble and you get into a lot of arguments, and it has to be one voice at certain points and make a certain decision, and then you take it in and work with it from there.
We're talking with the actor Ron Cephas Jones. If you see actors who have theater training doing TV or film, What is the advantage they have to people who haven't done live theater?
I wouldn't say advantage. I just say that they have a different way of approaching it.
How would you describe it?
Real. More real. It feels real than it looks real.
Yeah. They're better, is what you're saying. They're not acting.
Yeah. And that's the whole idea. Like Phil used to say, don't act. That was a big mantra of his. He used to say that. And he directed me in three plays. And that was one of the things he used to say. Number one, you are enough. And number two, don't act. So it's really about being and letting the situation, like the technique, let the action serve you. And whatever comes out of that, trust that it'll be right.
When a part like your part in This Is Us comes along, I would imagine it's an incredibly great experience, except if you kind of read toward the end of the series, you go, great part, but he looks like he's not very well.
Yeah.
So how do you react to getting an offer in a very well-written show and knowing that your character may not be around for multiple seasons?
It was difficult. It was difficult. First of all, the first instinct is the fear you won't have a job the next season.
Right.
That the character passes off and then you have to move on and audition again and find another project. The other thing was the idea that each day you didn't know what was going to happen. And so the feeling was very similar to waking up not knowing if it was going to have a job. So it was very, the fear was very similar in that each day I woke up as an actor, I didn't know whether my character was going to be living or not. So I didn't know whether I was, in hence, going to be living or not, basically, that life. So that was very difficult. Each episode, I would have to find out. I didn't know when. We had an idea that it was going to happen, but even then, they weren't quite sure if it was going to happen the first season. Once Dan made that decision, it was about which episode. So that was difficult, just waking up each day as William, not knowing if my life was going to end that particular day in that particular episode. So it served the character in a way.
If you are doing Othello on stage, the play is only really going to be as good as your Iago, ultimately. You're only going to be as good as the guy you're playing opposite. What is it like playing opposite Sterling K. Brown on this series?
Oh, it's amazing. Him and I work very similar, and that's why it's amazing.
In terms of technique?
That's right. And in terms of trust. You know, once you trust another actor, I'm trying to describe it, but it's about trust, John. You know, it's about having that trust. And Sterling and I we developed a trust right from the beginning. You know, I knew him from New York, saw him in a play prior to it. We had did a small workshop together. And I hadn't seen him since then. It was maybe 3 years going. And so, but I knew that when I met him and we started to read together that it was going to be some symbiotic stuff going on. And that's what eventually happened. You know, he's an incredible actor. So it was an honor to be able to share the screen with him and share tapes with him because, and everybody on that show is likewise, you know, but I work with Sterling the most. And it was just a joy.
There's an incredibly poignant scene in the past season involving a hospital bed. Do you remember what it was like shooting that day? Did you guys have some time to get in a place where you could be ready for that scene? Or was it like first shot of the day and it's like, go ahead? And
that's what it was, the first shot of the day. And I think both Sterling and I knew it was coming once we had gotten the script. So we were already prepared. We were prepared when we got there. And we were glad in the end that it was the first thing up. You know, so we were able to do it, and John and Glenn, the directors, they got it on the first two, maybe three takes, the intense part of it, and then the other stuff that you shoot around, but the close-ups and the long shot, we didn't take a lot of time with. It was just there. They got it, you know, so we didn't have to go over it and over it, you know.
When you are doing live theater, you know pretty much whether or not the scene's working. You can feel the audience, if they're with you or they're not with
you. That's right.
Can you get that on a film set,
you can,
on a TV
you
set?
Can.
Do you know?
Especially if the crew and all the people around you are invested with you. And we have a great crew and a great bunch of people. So you can get an idea and a sense from how those guys are feeling, even though they have to be quiet and they can't react. But they give you notices after the scene is over, and they'll give you a nod or a wink or, man, that was really good, or, wow, what a great scene, and we got it. You know, so you do get a sense of that. There's a sense of camaraderie that's involved, at least with this crew. You know, everybody's invested.
If they don't look you in the eye, you know, maybe you should do one more. You were working on shows like Mr. Robot, like The Get Down, Luke Cage, This Is Us. As an actor, to have that kind of variety of not just stories, but filmmakers. Yeah. I mean, Baz Luhrmann, you know, a great filmmaker making a TV series. What does that mean for you in terms of the people with whom you're collaborating, not just the material, but the filmmakers who are directing you now?
Oh, it's been great. You know, this has happened over the last just 3 years. 3-4 years, you know, so to have that wave or string of gigs in that medium says a lot about, you know, the casting in New York, which we talked about earlier, but giving me an opportunity to have my work exposed on a larger, broader base. So that's been incredible, especially with the advent of cable stuff that they're doing. It's just there's more opportunity to do good work, you know, so. And the pay levels are different, the contracts are different, but for the actor to be able to have an opportunity to do a good role in a medium that's broad, where you can get a broad fan base to see your work, where other directors and producers can see your work, just is a better situation, better opportunity. So I've been very blessed and grateful for that, you know, to be able to put a string of pieces together, but it's definitely due to the work that I've put in all the years, you know. So I'm very cognizant of that also. And so I give myself that. I earn that, you know.
Was there a point in your career where you said, I'm working my ass off, when are the good things going to come?
Absolutely.
And how do you stay with it?
Because it's love. You love doing
it. Because you couldn't imagine doing anything else?
Anything else, no. And I was doing good work all along.
I understand that, but it's good work versus being recognized
that's
for
right.
good work and,
well,
you
it's
know,
also
making
good
a living
work,
at it.
Making a living at it. That was the most fearful struggle. I mean, being famous and all that, you know, and, you know, I mean, it's like when you reach the heights of the theater world that I have, that's what I had always dreamed of. When I was coming up, there weren't a lot of African-American people on TV, let alone film, you know, doing great roles. There were few that you can point of, but there weren't as many at all. So the goal for me coming out of school was to be a great stage actor, you know, being a part of the Negro Ensemble Company with actors like Esther Rolle and Robert Hooks and Guinevere Smith. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but that was my goal, to be a great theater actor. And so as time went on, I started to see Denzel Washington blow up. I saw him do Richard III in The Park in 1988. And so my goal was to be a great actor. I wanted to be a great stage actor, and I hoped that that would bleed into a great television and film career. But it doesn't always work out like that.
I have a follow-up to Denzel playing Richard III. Do you remember the first part you had on stage that was not written for a black man?
Do I remember to say that again? Yeah.
The first part that you got where it wasn't, you weren't doing August Wilson. You were not cast. The character was not written black or white. They just wanted an actor who was good for the part.
Yeah, it was a Shakespeare play. It was Shakespeare.
you got to go back 400 years to find
it. Much Ado About Nothing. That's right. And then almost 20 years later, I ended up playing Richard III at the Public.
Wow. So Did Denzel come watch you?
No, he didn't. But quite a few others did, you know. So I was very proud of that, you know.
When you are thinking about what satisfies you creatively, television, as we've talked about, there's great writing, there's great direction, it's good living. What can you get out of theater that you can't get on TV, and how do you figure out how to balance the two and get back on stage, even though television is doing so well right now, and it certainly pays better?
It's hard to figure it out. I think it's all about timing, John, in terms of when the timing at this point, you know. And the theater is just live. Anything live like that is just exciting. You know, it gets the blood flowing. You know, it's just the whole idea that it's a live audience. And you can't compare that with television and film. And television and film has its other side to where it's broad and you have a broader base of people that see your work. But if the work's not good, if it's not good work and you're not satisfied with the work, then it becomes meaningless within. You know, you might make a lot of money, you might be popular, but if the work is not satisfying you, then something's going to be missing. So far, I haven't gotten to that point yet, you know, where I'm doing work that's not that satisfying. And I'm sure there'll be times when I will, you know, but the goal is hopefully to get good material so you can continue to grow, continue to see how you can peel back layers of a character and be consistent with that. So that's what I'm hoping for now, to continue to be consistent with my good work.
Let me ask you this last question. A year ago, about at the Upfronts in New York City, NBC presented This Is Us. And a lot of people who were there, including me, didn't get it. I remember one person said, "This is what?" When you're working on a show, do you know that it's good, even if other people are saying it's not any good? And a show like This Is Us, did you guys have a sense before it premiered that what you were doing was special and that the audience was going to recognize it? Or do you really not know?
Well, it's more about it was so good, we hope the audience would grab it. Sometimes things are so good, it goes above people's heads. It could be too good, right. And so that was a fear also, because I remember distinctly walking out of the first read of the pilot, Sterling and Susan and I looked at each other and we said, man.
Susan is?
Susan Kelechi Watson, yeah, who plays Sterling's wife. And we looked at each other and it was like, we knew we had something special. We were afraid to say it. You know, it was like we didn't want to mess that up. We were just like, this is really special. This is special. We all knew what it was like to read a good script.
So what does it mean that the audience recognizes that too?
It's just great. It brings the bar up. It raises the bar. Now other channels, other writers, other play, they're going to try to raise the bar. And shows are doing that now. The content of some of these shows is just so much better. Minus the action stuff, you know, the killing, that kind of stuff, which there's an audience for that too. But you can see that the writing in some of these amazing shows that are out there now, it's raising the bar. So that can only be a good thing.
So I guess the lesson is, if you want better television, watch better television, ignore bad television, and the cream will rise to the top.
The cream will rise to the top. That's right.
Ron Cephas-Jones, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. I'd love to come back again sometime.
The best in paranormal talk radio is here on Podcast One as part of the Jericho Network. Beyond the Darkness examines all aspects of the supernatural every day, Monday through Friday. And now, the same team behind Beyond the Darkness bring you the most frighteningly real-life dramas on True Crime Tuesday. Subscribe now by visiting darknessradio.com. Then click the True Crime Tuesday banner. Again, that's True Crime Tuesday. Visit darknessradio.com and click the True Crime Tuesday banner. Subscribe now.
You're listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
That was Ron Cephas-Jones on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to check us out on podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, and also be sure to subscribe and rate, review, and share on Apple Podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.